Forgot this morning completely. Bagels are so fat that it's hard to find one with a hole. But what we have here is a channel or pore that goes between the two cells. And it's large enough, in this case, for small molecules, ions, water, etc., to move back and forth between the two cells. Now, what's the point of a gap junction? It means that ions especially can flow from one cell to the other side. So that means if you have a change in the microenvironment on one side, that change is transmitted to the other side. And so if cells are joined by gap junctions, the entire group of cells can respond as a unit. In addition, nutrients and other things can move across. Now, gap junctions are unusually large for channels of this type, but they have many other features in common with other channels. And one feature they have in common is that they are gated. What is meant by that is the channel can be opened or closed in response to the appropriate signal. Most channels are gated by some trigger or other. The exact mechanism by which the channel is blocked is not known and may vary from channel to channel, but it can be closed and opened. Now, if you compare a gap junction with a tight junction, it's in some ways a similar idea, except instead of the bagel, you have a solid protein, no hole. And you have a smaller protein that doesn't stick out so far. So I brought another model. Now, here I wasn't able to embed a piece of bread, but I have instead a little piece of protruding paper. What I've really got here is a little bit from the rim of a paper plate. And the point is that this protein, which would again be a transmembrane protein, doesn't stick out very far. So now if I have two cells with these very small protrusions, if these two cell proteins come up against each other, again, the protein from one comes up against the protein from the other, the two cells will be very close to each other at that point. And this is what makes a tight junction. Now, although I haven't drawn it in the picture, in both the gap junction and in the tight junction, the proteins that make up the connection are anchored to the cytoskeleton. So that means if you freeze fracture a membrane containing these proteins, the protein is going to go with the P side of the membrane and not with the E side. So what's it going to look like? Remember, this is one bilayer here and another bilayer. If we were to freeze fracture one of these bilayers, what would happen? So if we open the bilayer, the protein is going to go with the P side or cytoplasmic side of the membrane. So that means if you look at the P face, you're going to see a series of bumps. And if you look at the E face, you're going to see a series of holes. Now, what's with an adhesive junction? Notice the spacing is larger and the proteins stick out further. And notice here the proteins are solid or like hooks. You don't have a channel here. They don't form any tunnel from one cell to the next. And in the case of an adhesive junction, it's much clearer that the proteins that stick out are anchored to the cytoskeleton. Because as shown in your picture, if you look in the cell, you can see that the proteins that stick out, the transmembrane proteins, are attached to a linker protein. electron microscope, the linker protein is visible. It forms a tight structure called a plaque. And then that plaque is linked to filaments in the cell. Now, there are actually two variants of adhesive junctions. And these are listed in your notes, so you don't have to worry about getting the terms exactly right. One kind is called a desmosome, and the other an adherens junction. Now, usually a desmosome has the shape of a button or a spot, while an adherens junction forms a belt. In a spot, what we mean is you have a bunch of these proteins forming a small button facing a button on the other side. And so the two come up against each other and hook. In the case of a belt, we mean that you have these kinds of proteins aligned along a cell. So you have a row of them, and the next cell has a row of them, and the two rows hook up. Now, another major difference between these is the type of filament they're linked to. Desmosomes are linked to intermediate filaments, and adherens junctions are linked to microfilaments. Now, when we finish talking about all these connections, we're going to talk about a cell type that has almost all of them and show you how they all fit in and how they hold things together. Now, everything I have discussed before so far involves a connection between one cell and the next. But remember, the cells are surrounded often by extracellular material. And sometimes the cells are sitting on top of a basal lamina, a layer of solid extracellular material. How are the cells linked to the extracellular material? They do that by something that looks very much like an adhesive junction, or half an adhesive junction. So you see a structure that looks something like this. You have one of these adhesive proteins linked to filaments, but instead of being hooked to another protein from another cell, it's hooked to some protein of the extracellular matrix. Now, just as there are two types of adhesive junctions, there are two types of connections that are very similar between the cell and the extracellular matrix. One is called a hemidesmosome, it looks exactly like half a desmosome. So that you have the plaque, you have the filaments, etc. And just like a desmosome, it's linked to intermediate filaments. The parallel to an adherens junction is called a focal adhesion. I should write it over here. Now, it's very much the same in that you have this transmembrane protein linked to some protein of the extracellular matrix. You have a linker protein, and it's connected to filaments, but of course it's connected to microfilaments. In the case of focal adhesions, the linker proteins do not form a visible plaque. All the other three, they do. All four cases, the transmembrane protein is linked to a linker, and the linker is linked to the filaments. But the middleman looks different in focal adhesions. Now, this highlights the similarities. What are the differences? The differences between the cell-cell connections and the cell-extracellular matrix is, of course, partially in what's on this end. Is it a hook from another cell, or is it extracellular matrix? Another major difference is the nature of the protein, that is the transmembrane protein that reaches out and hooks. In the case of the cell-cell connections, it's a cadherin that is a member of the protein family of cadherins, all of which are similar. And in the case of the cell extracellular matrix connections, it's an integrin. Now, these are two very famous classes or families of proteins that serve many important functions. And that's one of the reasons for mentioning their names, so you'll recognize them when it comes up again. Integrins are very important because they connect the inside of the cell to the cell extracellular matrix. And they are involved not just in a physical strength connection, which is what most adhesive junctions are about, but they're also important because they're involved in other functions, such as signaling. If the right compound is available and binds on the outside, that can change the shape of the protein on the inside and leads to some action in the cell. It also works the other way. Changes in conditions in the cell can change the shape of the integrin, which can change the signaling to the outside. So integrins are involved in many other functions, as well as maintaining the connection between the extracellular matrix and the cell. Now, I realized that I talked about the function of these adhesive junctions, which is basically structural and to hold things together, and the function of the gap junction. But what about the function of the tight junctions? Yes?
Because earlier we talked about the intermediate filaments, you said they only either outside the cell or in the nucleus.
No. Intermediate filaments are found in the cytoplasm, or in one class is found in the nucleus. And all the other intermediate filaments and the cytoskeleton are found in the cytoplasm. I may have said outside the cell, but I meant outside the nucleus in the cytoplasm. So, what is the function of a tight junction? A single tight junction is just a spot of connection. But these spots of connection are arranged in rows and in an irregular pattern. So along the surface of the cell, there would be a tight junction here, a tight junction here, 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 here. So there'd be a little bump here, a little bump here, a little bump, etc. And in the neighboring cell, there would be exactly the same pattern. So when the two cells came together, we wouldn't weld the two sides together completely, but we would have multiple spots at which we would form a tight junction between one cell and the next. So you have a network of tight junctions, usually in a band or a belt. Now, the function that this serves is, first of all, it prevents liquid from passing through between the cells. But even more important, perhaps, if you consider a cell, we have said that in the fluid mosaic model of the membrane, lipids can move around, and proteins that are not anchored can move around. But the tight junction band acts as a kind of beam in the middle, so that things cannot float past it. That the proteins and lipids on this side have to stay on this side, and the proteins and lipids on that side have to stay on that side. And to illustrate how important this is, we really want to look at some real cells in which there are two parts of the surface that have to be kept separate. And the kind of cells that I want to talk about are epithelial cells. But to understand really how what they are, we have to talk a little bit about specialized cells in general. So before I do that and leave these connections, are there any questions about this?
Can you explain how the button versus belt works?
The button versus belt will be a little clearer when I take a real cell. It's really an orange juice carton, but you'll get the idea. Yeah. What's the difference? These are just different proteins. They have different amino acid sequences and different three-dimensional structures. They have certain similarities, but they're just two different classes of protein. And if you want to know their exact structure, chapter 17 of Becker has many, many more details about all of this. Now, you don't have to know it, but if it's easier for you to read the general picture and then back off, great.
There's only one adhesive protein, I guess, between an adhesive junction.
In an adhesive junction, is there only one protein? Probably only one kind of protein, but there are many molecules of it. It's like Velcro. You don't have one hook. You have multiple hooks.
And also, what's the diameter of the hole?
What's the diameter of the hole? I don't know the answer to that. It's well known. It's in the book. It has to be smaller than 2 to 4 nanometers, but I don't know quite how big it is.
Why is that smaller than 2 to 4?
Well, because of the way they draw the pictures, I'm pretty sure it is, that it's smaller than the gap. But it's the size of the... of the hole in the bagel, so to speak, is large enough for molecules the size of glucose to get through, but not proteins. One more. What's the constitution of plaque? It's really just a lot of proteins stuck together. Many of these things were first observed in the electron microscope and described before they were understood. And so plaque was just used to mean something that looked solid. Excuse me? The linker protein itself is quite densely packed, and that's what forms the plaque. Again, there are pictures of all of these things in Becker and many on the web if you just go to Google Images and type in the name of the structure. Also, I have added to the website a page that has a list of interesting websites and URLs, and one of the things on there is a really what amounts to an anatomy collection of pictures of just about everything. So, let's consider cells now for a minute, as opposed to connectors. If you look at humans, there really, or any multicellular organism, there really is no such thing as a typical cell. Every cell is specialized to do something that contributes to the welfare of the whole organism. There are, in fact, people think, about 200 different cell types in a human. But fortunately for those of us who like to keep track of it, there seem to be really only about 4 kinds. Now, when people talk about kinds, they're really talking not so much about cells, but about tissues. And what they mean by a tissue is a group of similar cells, cells that are similar in structure and function and work as a unit. And there appear to be 4 major kinds. And they are muscle, nerve, connective, and epithelial. Now, you all know what muscle is, and we'll talk later in greater detail about the actual molecular structure and how it allows you to move. We've talked a little bit about nerve cells, which are specialized for conducting messages. They're not all long and thin, but they tend to be. Connective tissue is tissue that is surrounded by an extensive extracellular matrix. And that matrix can be solid, as in bone. It can be gel-like, as in cartilage. Or it can be liquid, as in blood. But in all those cases, there's an extensive matrix. Now, some people are lumpers, and some people are splitters. Whenever you have classifications, some people like a lot of classifications, some people like the minimum. The lumpers say there are only four categories. The splitters say there are five because they consider blood to be a separate category. We're going to stick with four, but it doesn't make all that much difference. It's a small number. And the last category is epithelial. And that's what I really want to talk about now. I want to talk about epithelial cells. These are cells that tend to be tightly joined and use all of these structures we've been talking about and to form sheets or layers. So they make up the linings of things. For example, you have an epithelial layer around your gut. You have an epithelial layer around your blood vessels. You have an epithelial layer around the tubes that carry gases through your lungs, through the bronchi, and so on. So the easiest way to explain them is to look at a real example. So if you look at the top of 4A, we want to take a look at the epithelial cells that line the intestine. So these are my sample cells over here. One of them has been cut away so we can look at the inside. And the thing you should notice about these quote-unquote cells, if this were an epithelium, they would be spread out all over the desk, and each one is joined to the others. These cells are polarized, meaning like actin, like microfilaments, like microtubules, they have a head end and a tail end. The top of the cells is different from the bottom of the cells. Now, how are these cells set up and organized and connected? Let's pretend this is a piece of your digestive system, say your intestine. So this is the tube that goes through you. And of course, it's lined by a sheet of cells. So there's a sheet of cells wrapped around here. So there'd be one cell, another cell, etc. I actually have another tube that has a few paper towels left that's marked into cells, and I grabbed the wrong one. So if you take this and you make a cross-section, if you look on your handout, that's what we've done first. So we made a cross-section, and what would that look like? That would look like this. And this space in the middle is called, like any enclosed space, is called the lumen. And it's surrounded by a layer of cells. Now, it doesn't actually look like this because this layer is folded. It's not smooth. And so that's why I've drawn the next picture like this. Now, I got lazy and I didn't mark it all the way around. But this is completely divided into cells. What we've done here is to push it in, push it in, push it in, instead of a smooth circle of cells that's wrinkled. And that increases the surface area. Now, you know the story about how fleas have little fleas on them. This indentation is called the villus. But then each cell has smaller indentations on the side facing the lumen. So that's why we've written something like this. The membrane on the side facing the lumen is again folded into little protrusions, which are called, each one is called a microvillus. These protrusions are kept up by little microfilaments, and they're nice pictures of that in your books. Now, the net effect of all this is that the inner surface, the luminal surface here, is extremely extensive because it's very heavily folded. And people have calculated the area of this surface of your small intestine is on the order of size of a tennis court. So there is a huge area which is exposed to what's in your intestine and which allows for absorption. So there's a huge area over which you can absorb material from what you eat into your body. Because if stuff is going to reach your body, it has to go across this layer. Now, in our next picture, what we've done is to just take a few cells and look at them more carefully. So I've taken a few cells from here and sort of straightened them out. And that looks like this. One of the reasons I draw these, give these crude handouts, is I can reproduce them almost on the board. Now, as we've explained, this surface, the surface facing the lumen, is extensively folded and covered with microvilli. On the other hand, the surface facing the body, which is over here, that surface is relatively flat, and in fact, it's on top of a basal lamina. Which serves as a support for the cells. So that would be here. It serves as a support for the cells and also as a kind of filter. So these cells are polarized. Their two surfaces are different in structure and composition. So the surface on the top is called the luminal or the apical surface. And the surface on the bottom is called the basolateral. So now if we look at that a little more closely, here we have three cells. They're polarized, as we said. This is where the lumen would be. So these are the surfaces that would have microvilli here. The basal lamina would be on top of the desk. And of course, the cells would extend in every direction. So they wouldn't just be joined this way. They'd also be joined that way and that way. And they'd be joined to the basal lamina on the bottom. So these cells actually have all of the structures that we've described except for focal adhesions. Focal adhesions are usually not found in epithelial cells. They're found in cells that are growing on a solid layer like in a petri dish, and where they have to spread out and or move. In the picture in Becker, which is referenced on your handout, all of these structures are shown in the same cells, so you can get some idea of how they would fit. But in a real cell, we'd have everything but focal adhesions. So how do they go? So if you look at the picture now, the final one, which has a blow up of a couple of cells and matches my cartons, what are we looking at there? So the microvilli on the top, on the apical surface. And then here you have a band of tight junctions, which is represented by the green tape. So that means that on the surface of the cell where the green tape is, there is a web of these tight junctional proteins. So that there's a ridge and ridge and ridge and a ridge. There's a network of ridges here joined to the next cell. Now, because it's ridges, it means, again, we don't have one flat cell against another. But these ridges are sufficient that even though it's bump, 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 and not solid, water cannot sneak through. And so as a result, if this is your epithelium, this is your layer, and inside here is the lumen with the food that you ate, if you ate, say, candy and you have glucose in solution, the solution cannot go between the cells. The only way that glucose can get to your body is if it goes into the epithelial cell through the apical membrane and out through the basolateral membrane into your body. And one of the things we'll start discussing today and finish next time is how you actually transport something like glucose. How do you get it into the cell appropriately and out of the cell appropriately? So we have these tight junctions, and they not only keep liquid from seeping between the cells, but remember, they act as a boom to prevent the proteins in the apical part from diffusing into the basolateral part and vice versa. So, of course, one of the interesting questions is when the cell makes a protein, how does it know where to go? And this is something we'll return to and talk about a little bit more later, how you target a protein to the right part of the cell. And then, of course, once it gets there, because of the tight junctions, it can't go into the other part. Now, the next picture thing shown is a belt adhesion. An adhesion belt or an adherence junction, and that's drawn like this. And we put a little gap here to the next cell to make it clear that it's not a tight junction, but there's a gap between the cell. So there would be proteins sticking out here. There would be cadherin sticking out here and cadherin sticking out here, but they would be all along here. So it would be sort of like Velcro with these two reds sticking to each other. Now what's happening inside the cell is that the cadherins inside are linked to the linker proteins and then to microfilaments. And the chances, it's thought that the microfilaments they're linked to are primarily going around the cell in a belt, not just sticking in. So there's a belt inside of microfilaments of actin, and the cadherins are linked to that. Now, underneath these two belts of tight junctions and adherence junctions, then we have additionally, of course, we have gap junctions. So the structure that looks like this is meant to be a gap junction going between the two cells, one bagel in this cell membrane, one bagel in the next cell membrane, and it's connected. So it's like you have a bagel embedded in the sides of the orange juice container, except the scale is way off. It would probably be something more the size of a lifesaver, or even smaller. Now, if you look back here in our cutaway cell, you see something that looks like that, and that's meant to be the end of the gap junction going to the cell that's behind the board. So there are gap junctions here, and in addition, there are desmosomes linking the two cells. And I've tried to symbolize those by these little things that look like this. These are desmosomes joining the cells as well. And then the final thing we want to put in here is a hemidesmosome. So if underneath this is a layer, the basal lamina, the bottom of the cell is connected to the basal lamina by a hemidesmosome. So if we looked at the cutaway one, there'd be one here. So in our cells here, what we're seeing is there are desmosomes and gap junctions here which connect to the next cell. And of course, also connect to the back, connect to the side, connect out front. But there would be hemidesmosomes here connecting to the basal lamina underneath. Now, epithelial cells are generally serve as barriers. They are protective, and also they serve as an absorptive layer, a selective absorption. As we've already mentioned, they determine what gets across from the contents of your intestine to your body. They also secrete things or release things in the other direction, and how they do that we'll get to later. Now, this is structure for the moment. And what I want to talk about next is transport, how you actually move things across the membranes. So before I do that, let me ask if there are any questions. Yeah.
Why is it called
Why are blood cells in their own category?
No.
If blood cells are included, they're considered connective. And they're just considered to have a liquid extracellular matrix. That is, you have the plasma in which the blood cells are found. Yes?
I thought I understood from what you said earlier that tight junctions provide, within the cell itself,
The question is, how do the tight junctions lead to a differentiation between parts?
Within the cell, or is it only on the outside?
No, it's within the cell, but because of the point is that the proteins that make up the tight junction are embedded in this membrane, and they form a ridge. And so even if they weren't connected to anything, they would prevent diffusion of proteins across this way, which they do.
There's no barrier.
Well, you're saying inside and outside, this is a solid membrane. And we're talking about diffusion in this membrane. We're not talking about diffusion in here. Now, the question is, why doesn't the stuff in here end up in here? This stuff is reasonably mixed. There are things moving across this way. But proteins get locked into the membrane so that this surface is different from the properties of this surface. Other questions? Okay. So now we want to look at the other side of the handout. No, not the other side of that one. At 4B, which is on the other handout. Think about transport and the various kinds of transport. We said, for example, that glucose has to go into these cells through the apical surface and out through the basolateral surface. And it turns out that the transport mechanism for the two is not the same. How do you think about transport? Well, there are really three issues involved, and it's helpful to think of it in those terms. What we're really talking about is you have a membrane, and now you have substance X on one side of it. And the question is, what does it take to get X to the other side? Now, we could be talking about X going in, we could be talking about X going out. The argument is basically the same. The question is, what allows X to pass the membrane? Now, we mentioned last time that CO2 and other gases simply diffuse across a membrane. In the case of something like CO2, no carrier is required. And this is the big first question. Do you need a protein to assist in getting X across the membrane or not? Is a protein required? What kind of protein is it? That's question one. What's with the protein, if any? Now, question two is the energy issue. What does it take to push X across? Where does the energy come from to do it? And the third question involves a more complicated case. In many cases, you don't have one thing that moves, you have several. For example, consider the anion exchanger that we talked about. Two things are moving at once. So if you have multiple things moving, the question is, what is their relative direction? Are they moving in opposite directions, as with the anion exchanger, or are they moving in the same direction at the same time? So these are the three things, and if you keep these straight, you can usually know what you're talking about. So let's consider the possibilities. And these are outlined on the top of 4B. On the bottom of 4B, we have the details about each case that we're interested in. They're partially for reference and partially so you don't have to write it all down. So issue one is the protein. Do you need a protein or don't you? So no protein, that's the first big divide. Protein or no. If you don't need a protein, that's case one, which as it says on the bottom, is called simple diffusion. As we have said, gases, for example, can move across membranes by simple diffusion. In the case of biological systems, the important things that move across membranes by simple diffusion are gases and lipid-soluble compounds. Many hormones are lipid-soluble, and they can move in and out of cells without any assistance from other proteins or proteins. Some of that, they're not proteins, so they don't need any assistance from proteins or carriers of any kind. Everything else requires some kind of protein. Anything that is either strongly hydrophilic or big enough requires some sort of protein to do the transporting. But the proteins are divided into two major categories. The protein can be a channel, or it can be a transporter. Now, what's the difference? We've already met one example of a channel, which is the gap junction. The basic idea of a channel is you have a protein in the membrane, and the protein has a hydrophilic interior, which allows water-soluble things to move through it. But a channel is relatively inert. Once it's in place, things are relatively free to go through, sort of like an open door. Channels are specific, but they don't have, the channel protein does not form an intimate complex with what it moves. And there aren't any major changes in conformation. The bagel pretty much sits there. Now, this is in contrast to a transporter. A transporter protein is more not like just sort of a plain open door. It's more like a revolving door. It has moving parts. It has to combine with the substance it moves, just like an enzyme combines with its substrate. And then it has to change conformation or shape in a major way. So it picks up the X on one side of the membrane, changes shape, and lets go on the other side of the membrane. So it both has an intimate association with what it moves, and it has major changes in conformation. And both of those are true of transporters, but not of channels. So if transport through a channel is case two, everything else uses a transporter. Now, what are channels used for in living systems? There are large channels, usually called pores, like the gap junction. And then there are smaller channels. In the kidney, there are channels for water. Water can pass through most membranes, but relatively slowly. If you move a lot of water through a membrane, it will have water channels. So water channels are found in the kidney. Most channels, however, are channels for ions. These are the most common. And so when people talk about channels, they often mean ion channels. And each channel type is specific for one or a few ions. So we have channels that allow things to pass that couldn't by themselves get through a membrane. But what about transporters? We've basically talked now about the issues involving protein. You either have no protein, you have a channel protein, or you have a transporter style protein. And now we have to consider the energy issue. What is pushing X around? And there are two possibilities here. You can have what's called passive transport, or you can have what's called active. Now, what's the big difference? Is that in passive transport, nobody is pushing X around. It's X is all by itself. In the case of passive transport, it is the concentration of X that drives X. X goes from where it's high to where it's low. So X goes down its gradient of concentration from where it's high to where it's low. Now, it could be going into the cell if there's more X on the outside. It could be leaving the cell if there's more X on the inside. But the point is it goes from where it's high to where it's low. The concentration of X itself is what is driving the movement of X. However, in active transport, X is not going down its gradient. So this is passive. By contrast, for active transport, X is going from where it's low to where it's high. It's already higher, and we're still pushing more of it. And in order for this to work, some other reaction, which is downhill and provides energy, has to push X. So passive, it's the gradient of X that drives it. In the case of active, it's something else. It's another reaction. So we can divide it now. There are transporters which help X move down its gradient. And there are transporters which push X up its gradient, which are usually called pumps. So X goes down its gradient, X goes up. Now let's see how I wrote it on the handout. I wrote down and up. Now, if X is using a transporter to go down its gradient, that's category 3. Now, all three categories, 1, 2, and 3, have the same situation with regard to energy. In all three of these cases, X is moving down its gradient from high concentration to low, and the energy is provided simply by the concentration or gradient of X. What's the difference? In the case number 1, there's no protein at all. In case number 2, we have a channel, which is allowing X to flow through the hole in the channel. And in the case of 3, we actually have a carrier protein, or a transporter protein, which is picking up X on one side of the membrane and dumping it on the other side. Now, what are we going to call these things? If there's no protein at all, it's called simple diffusion. These other two are usually lumped together and called facilitated diffusion. Now, the terminology here is not universal, and not everybody calls these things exactly the same thing. So you should be forewarned. And that has to do with how it was discovered. People discovered 1 and 3, and they discovered 2 later. Now, both of these are called facilitated diffusion. Facilitated because you need a protein. diffusion, because X goes down its gradient. It just diffuses from a high concentration area to low. However, they're clearly not the same. They're very, very different in mechanism. In one case, you just have a relatively fixed hole through which X goes. And in another case, you have a protein with moving parts that is shuttling the X along. So usually people use different names for these two processes. I think this is blocking the view. So people call this number two, it's called either channel-mediated facilitated diffusion or channel-facilitated diffusion or facilitated fusion through a channel or something like that. Case three is sometimes called carrier-mediated diffusion or facilitated diffusion through a carrier, etc. So we'll try in this course to be specific and to indicate when we mean through a channel and when we mean with a carrier. But both are usually called facilitated diffusion. Although you'll see on one of your handouts, it's a little different. Okay. So 1 through 3 are the same in respect to where the energy comes from. But what about 4 and 5? 4 and 5 are both different in that they are active transport, in that X moves up its gradient. So what's the difference between the two of them? We want to add that because that's our final two cases. These two also have multiple names. And what I've written on the critical thing here, though, is where does the energy come from to push X? Now, you have a process like pushing X around. You want to push it up its gradient. It requires energy. Where in the cell are you likely to get the energy from? What substance are you likely to break down? Same answer as last semester. What'd you say? ATP. So what the usual thing when you need energy is you break down some ATP. And so that is one way to do it. You use the energy is from ATP directly. The alternative is the energy is not directly from ATP. What this usually means is that using ATP, you make a gradient of some ion. Then the gradient of that ion running down provides the energy to move X. ATP is behind it ultimately, but ATP is not directly involved because ATP did something else and the something else runs, pushes X. So let's look at some examples of this. I realized we didn't actually do an example of three. So maybe I should mention that before we leave, that glucose enters the cells lining the intestine from what you ate. And then the glucose has to get out the bottom to get into the blood and be carried around. It leaves the bottom by carrier-mediated facilitated diffusion. There's an active process which piles up the glucose in the cells. And then glucose diffuses, so to speak. Using a carrier protein, it goes down its gradient out of the cell. So now we want to consider how does it get in this end. That's number 5, and we'll come back to that. But let's look at an example then of directly using the energy from ATP or indirectly. And these are often called primary active transport and secondary. to erase some more, I think, to write this right. Okay. So in the case of primary active transport, we have X going, as I wrote up there, from low to high. And simultaneously, we're breaking down ATP. Now, when X goes down its gradient, the free energy is favorable, the delta G is negative. When X goes up its gradient, though, the delta G is positive. But when you break down ATP, the delta G is very negative. So the net result of these two together is negative. And I've written them as separate arrows on your handout, but it really should be something like that. The two reactions are actually coupled. A single protein breaks the ATP and uses that energy to push X. And such a protein is often called a pump because it is pumping X up against its concentration. Now, what's an example of this, of primary active transport? We mentioned the lysosomes in the cell. The lysosomes and some other compartments, some other organelles, are relatively acid. So that means the pH is low and the proton concentration is high. Lysosomes contain enzymes, remember, that degrade things. We didn't mention this, I think, last time, but they work best at an acid pH. Now, this may be a kind of defense, because if one of the enzymes gets out into your cytoplasm, the pH is wrong. And so it's not as likely to destroy the cell and eat you up. But inside the lysosome, the pH is very low, and that's the enzyme's optimum pH. And the only way this works is you have a protein, a pump, that uses the energy of ATP to push protons into the lysosomes. So you have a pump protein in the membrane. Another example is that in the ER, especially in muscle and nerve, there is a very high level of calcium. Well, how does that calcium get there? The calcium is removed from the cytoplasm and pumped in at the expense of ATP. So you have to have a pump in the ER membrane that moves calcium at the expense of ATP. So those are two examples of primary active transport. So how does secondary active transport work? This time, you combine moving X from low to high with moving something else from high to low. Something else goes down its gradient, and that provides the energy to push X. Now, on the notes, I just wrote Y, because there's more than one thing that can do this. But a very common thing that does this is sodium. It's sodium moves from where it is high to where it is low. And since this is down its gradient, this provides energy which is sufficient to push X. Now, in order for this to work, you have to have a sodium gradient. It just so happens that virtually all cells contain a pump. They contain a protein that carries out primary active transport. It uses the energy of ATP and uses the energy to move sodium out and potassium in at the expense of ATP. This is primary active transport. This is called the sodium-potassium pump. And this is a very important protein. All cells have it, and people have calculated that when the body is at rest, somewhere between 5 and 40% of the energy consumed by the body is just to run this pump. This pump is extremely important because it maintains a gradient of potassium high on the inside, sodium high on the outside. These gradients then can be used to signal or to do work. If you make a hole or open a channel, the appropriate channel, either potassium will go out or sodium will go in, and this can serve as a signal. In addition, the sodium especially going down its gradient, that is, into the cell, provides energy to push other things around. So it is very common to have sodium rushing down its gradient, and that in turn pushes X. And this is usually what this is called, depends on that famous issue of direction. Remember we said if there's more than one thing, you have to think about direction. Sometimes the sodium and the X go in the same direction. And that's called symport. But as you can see in this example, sometimes things go in opposite directions, sodium and potassium. That's called antiport. So sometimes the sodium and the X go in the same direction, and then usually it's called a co-transporter. And if they go in opposite directions, it's often called, though not always, an exchanger. We already met an example of an exchanger, not one that uses sodium, but a different one. What was that? Remember the anion exchanger? Bicarb chloride. That's an example of an exchanger. Now, remember we said that the glucose that you eat has to get into these cells? It does it by co-transport with sodium. Because of the sodium-potassium pump, the sodium in here is low. So sodium comes in from your gut, and the energy of the sodium pushes the glucose. So glucose, by secondary active transport, gets into your cells, and then it leaves by facilitated diffusion, carrier-mediated. Now, I want to wrap this up. Yeah? How does the sodium moving out actually move the glucose in? We will talk about some models for it later. The general idea is that you have something like a revolving door which is pushed by the sodium, and that catches the glucose and pushes it. That's a very shorthand version, and we'll talk some more about it next time. But we talked last semester about coupled reactions. And it's the same sort of idea that you can, by having the appropriate machine or protein, you can rig it so that if one half happens, that makes the other half happen, and vice versa. So these two don't happen independently, they only happen together. Are there any more questions before I go on? Yeah. How does gating of a channel work? There are two theories about how it works. One is that you basically twist it and you sort of cut it off in the middle. And the other is that you have a sort of loose flap of protein, like a ball and chain, and the ball fits in. And I think some channels may be one way, some the other. But the idea is that the channel changes in conformation. As we will see, her question is, how do you gate it? One of the most interesting questions is what triggers gating. Some channels are gated or triggered to open or close in response to ion changes or electricity, some in response to physical changes like touch or tension, and some in response to binding chemicals. So we'll talk about the roles of all these different kinds of gated channels in getting the things you want done, done. Now, I want to speak very briefly about how you measure transport. This is shown briefly on the other side of your handout. We're just going to talk about it a little bit today, and then I want you to bring it back next time, and we'll talk about how you get all those curves and so on. But what I want to explain is the basic method. You want to take some cells and see how much stuff do they take up or how much stuff do they release. And one of the common ways of doing this is to use red blood cell ghosts that we talked about last time. Remember, a ghost is a red blood cell that has basically been emptied of its contents. And because you can crack it open and reseal it, you can ensure any solution you want inside with any concentration. So what you do is you have a solution of ghosts. And usually you've set it up so they have no X inside at all. And then you put X in the solution. And then at various intervals of time, you take out a little of the solution, separate the cells from the solution, and then measure how much X is in the cells. And that allows you to measure uptake over time. And from that information, you can, in fact, distinguish all of the in variations on it. You can distinguish from the properties of the transport which of the cases you're dealing with and how things are getting in and out of cells. And that's what we're going to talk about next time. So bring back your handout, and we'll go over the various cases, how you can tell, and how you can manipulate it.